Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 5th, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing pension reform, the Detroit bankruptcy case, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome to today's call, we welcome back Professor David Skeel. He is the S. Samuel Arsht Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and he's going to give us some opening remarks of about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we'll move right to your questions. So please, as you're listening to his opening remarks, be thinking about your questions. And with that, Professor Skeel, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks everybody who's on the call. I'm going to be talking about the general question of ultimately whether pensions can be restructured in bankruptcy. Obviously, this is not just a hypothetical question. At this point, for a number of reasons. One is that there are pension problems in cities and states across the country. The other, as maybe everybody on this call knows, is that the pension issue was a big part of a big decision that was just handed down in the Detroit bankruptcy case. So let me start with that very briefly. What the judge was deciding in the Detroit case was whether Detroit is a proper debtor under Chapter 9, the municipal bankruptcy laws. As part of that decision, many of us thought that he didn't have to decide whether pensions can be restructured, and many of us, including me, thought he probably wouldn't purport to decide that issue, but he surprised many of us by addressing it, by deciding it. The judge said that Detroit's pensions can be restructured in bankruptcy. There's a Michigan constitutional provision that says that pensions can't be diminished or impaired. The judge said that bankruptcy is federal law. Bankruptcy, in a sense, overrides that provision, and we can talk about some of the details of that in just a couple of minutes. What I thought I would do after mentioning the Detroit case is very quickly do four things. One is talk about really briefly about the extent of the pension problem. Second, talk about the key issue, and what I think is the most important issue in Detroit's bankruptcy and in a lot of other municipal and state situations right now as well, or municipal situations at least, and that is whether pensions can be restructured in bankruptcy. We don't have a state bankruptcy law now, but we do obviously have a municipal bankruptcy law. Third thing I'll do is talk about three of the main arguments against restructuring pensions in bankruptcy. And then I'll finally talk briefly about some of the benefits of being able to restructure pensions in bankruptcy. So first, the extent of the problem. I don't need to say much about this. I think everybody is familiar with just how huge a pension problem, public pension problem, we have nationwide. Detroit's pensions are an estimated $3.5 billion underfunded. Chicago's in the news right now with its pension, are somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $30 billion unfunded. Illinois' pensions are a stated $97 billion underfunded, but probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $200 billion underfunded. How did we get here? Well, we got here in part because of the recent recession, but much more importantly because of a structural problem in the way pension promises were made. Pension bargaining over public pension promises is different than bargaining over other kinds of obligations. It's different in several respects, the most important of which is in many circumstances there wasn't real bargaining going on. The beneficiaries of these pension promises wanted big pensions. The politicians are responsive to those beneficiaries because they're voters and they're also an important interest group. And so both sides were pushing for big and in many cases excessive pensions. Second thing, can pensions be restructured in bankruptcy? In my view, the key issue in the Detroit case, the key issue with respect to municipal bankruptcy. In my view, as in the Detroit judge's view, I think he was right about what he decided earlier this week. In my view, pensions can be restructured in bankruptcy, but I believe they can only be restructured to the extent that they're underfunded. So to the extent funds have been set aside for pensions, that portion of the pension will be protected. But if funds have not been set aside, as in many of these cases they have not, they can be restructured. So here's very briefly the reasoning that I have in mind in reaching this conclusion. The basic idea is that in bankruptcy, a creditor is fully protected, any creditor is fully protected to the extent they have collateral. So if a creditor lends a debtor $100 and this repayment obligation is secured by, say, a widget worth $70, so the debtor puts up a widget as collateral, the $70 worth of collateral would be protected. That can't be taken away from the creditor in bankruptcy. It's fully protected. But the $30 difference, the difference between the value of the property and the $100 extent of the obligation, can be restructured and regularly is restructured in bankruptcy. In my view, more or less the same reasoning applies to pensions. And so the idea there would be that if $70 have been set aside to fund a pension obligation that currently, you know, the present value of the current obligation is $100, the $70 would be protected, the other $30, the $30 difference, could be restructured. Another way to put the same point is that once the money has been set aside, as long as it has in fact been set aside, as it has, to my knowledge, in Detroit, Detroit or whoever the municipality is no longer and its creditors no longer have an interest in that money. That money has been set aside and it's available for pension beneficiaries. But to the extent the money has not been set aside, the pension can be restructured. So what are some of the arguments against restructuring pensions? Arguments that pensions cannot be restructured in bankruptcy in general, in Detroit in particular. As I mentioned, I'll briefly talk about the three main arguments as I see it. The first argument is that the Michigan State Constitution says that pensions shall not be diminished or impaired. This was a provision that was put into the Michigan State Constitution in 1963. It's the provision that pension beneficiaries are pointing to when they say their pensions can't be restructured. In my view, this provision doesn't stand for that idea at all. What the purpose of the provision was in 1963 was to make clear that the pension promise is a real promise, that it's a contractual obligation of the state. Before 1963 in Michigan, as in many states, pensions were treated as gratuities. That's the legal term that was used in the case law. A pension promise was a gratuity, and what that meant is the city or the state could change their mind about it at any time. So when Michigan put a provision in its constitution saying pensions shall not are contractual obligations and they shall not be diminished or impaired, what it's saying is we're not going to change our mind about the promise. It's not saying that that promise cannot be restructured in bankruptcy. And in fact, I think there are very good reasons to believe the background assumption was that they could be restructured in bankruptcy. In addition to the basic logic of what that state provision was for, the supremacy clause of the Constitution says that federal bankruptcy law trumps state law, even state constitutional law, and it's quite clear in bankruptcy, an obligation like this can be restructured, and the bankruptcy rules on that are likely to prevail. The second argument against restructuring pensions is an argument that not just a restructuring of pensions, but all of Chapter 9, all of municipal bankruptcy, violates the Contracts Clause of the Constitution. And the argument here is that because the municipal bankruptcy laws enable cities, enable an entity of the state to alter contracts, they are effectively violating the Contracts Clause of the Constitution, which says that states and their entities cannot change contracts once contracts have been entered into. So the idea is that even though municipal bankruptcy law is federal law, it is facilitating a restructuring of contracts by states. States can't do that, and therefore all of municipal bankruptcy, not just the restructuring of pensions, violates the Contracts Clause. I actually think this is a stronger argument, but ultimately I believe that will fail as well. The context of it is, back in the 1930s, when Congress passed its first municipal bankruptcy laws, the Supreme Court in 1936 struck down a municipal bankruptcy law on exactly these grounds, that it facilitated a violation of the Contracts Clause. 2 years later, in 1938, the Supreme Court changed its mind. It said municipal bankruptcy is constitutional, doesn't violate the Contracts Clause. I think that the Supreme Court would continue to adhere to the 1938 decision and continue to say Chapter 9 is constitutional, but the argument that that 1938 case should be reversed and might be reversed is not a silly argument. I think it won't be, but the Contracts Clause claim does strike me as a claim that deserves serious consideration. The final major argument against restructuring is that Chapter 9 itself, the terms of Chapter 9, would prevent a restructuring of pensions. And the particular provision that that pension beneficiaries point to is a provision that says the Chapter 9 readjustment plan can't do anything that is, quote, prohibited by law. And so the argument is that this prevents a restructuring of pensions because Michigan law says you can't impair or diminish a pension. I think that's a misreading of that Chapter 9 provision. What that Chapter 9 provision is designed to do, in my view, is prevent any violation of state law after the restructuring. It's not meant to prevent or interfere with a restructuring. If it was, then Chapter 9 wouldn't allow any restructuring of anything. So I think what that provision, you can't do things prohibited by law, means is that once you've restructured the obligations going forward, you can't be violating any state law. So finally, and very briefly, what are some of the benefits of restructuring pensions? Well, the first and most obvious benefit is that cities like Detroit, and there's some other possibilities out there as well, Chicago is one people mention as having really serious problems, may not have any other realistic way of dealing with their structural pension crises. To the extent their pension promises are so out of control that there's no hope of climbing out of the hole they're in, restructuring provides a way to address that problem. Second, and at least as important in my view, the possibility of a restructuring, the fact that pensions can be restructured and that now people realize they can be restructured, I think could have a very positive effect on public pension politics. In a world where an excessive, overly generous pension promise is going to be subject to restructuring, I think that public employees and state representatives are going to look at the pension bargaining process a little bit differently. The pension beneficiaries are going to have to take into consideration, is this promise realistic? Is it sustainable? They're also going to have to pay more attention to whether pensions are actually being funded. And I think one of the biggest benefits of a conclusion pensions can be restructured is that it could improve our politics in the way few other legal changes can. So let me stop with that and just take any questions you all have.
All right. Thank you very much, Professor. We're going to open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for Professor Skeel, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Skeel, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Phone lines are open. While we're waiting to see who might ring in, Professor, let me ask you a question. I should have noted at the outset you did a white paper, which published it for the Federalist Society on October 30th, on some of these issues. I'm wondering if you've gotten much response or pushback, especially from academia, on your paper covering many of these same issues.
Well, it has led to a lot of conversations about this, and somewhat to my surprise, the biggest pushback has been pushback from people saying, I don't think any part of a pension promise is protected. I've expected to get pushback from the other side, and there has been a little bit of that. I've expected to get pushback from people saying, you just can't restructure pensions. Skeel, you are misreading that Michigan provision, and either Detroit can't file for bankruptcy at all, or if it can file for bankruptcy, pensions can't be touched. That's not been most of the pushback I've got. Most of the pushback I've gotten is arguments that this doesn't look like normal property rights, the funds that have been set aside for pensions, and there's no state law that says there is a security interest in the funds that have been set aside. In my view, my arguments are sound. I do the case law in analogous areas suggests that Detroit and its creditors do not have any interest in funds that have been set aside, as long as the funds have in fact been set aside. But that's where a lot of the debate has been. It's more of it's been, am I suggesting too little about the restructuring possibility, and not as much am I right about whether there can be any restructuring at all?
And is that discussion happening between you and other academics or practitioners or policy setters?
It's mostly academics that I've had these conversations with. I have gotten some emails from people, including some people where you are, Dean, in Washington, about this, and I have an email on my screen asking me the question, exactly how would you allocate this property to the pension beneficiaries? And I think that's a really hard question. I think it's pretty clear to me that the funds that have been set aside, that the two major Detroit pensions have, are available for Detroit's pension beneficiaries, and they're not going to be otherwise part of the case. But the question of how do you allocate those funds among the past and current Detroit employees, I think is a really complicated question, and I'm tempted to say it's over my head. I'm going to think it through and hopefully come up with an answer. But most of the reaction I've gotten, at least directly, has been from academics and from people who have some sort of stake in it, either because they're a staffer in Washington or they're somehow involved in the Detroit case.
Okay. I should let folks know that we typically try to send out a real-time reminder, an email reminder, as these calls begin. I'm advised that the reminder for today's call went out late. So we are speaking with Professor David Skeel about the pension reform matters and the Detroit bankruptcy case. And feel free to answer any question, or ask any question, rather, even if you think that he might have addressed the issue in his opening remarks. We're in the question phase now. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller with a question, so let's go to that caller.
Hi. The whole discussion over pensions, you know, is obviously interesting. Some people think that, you know, obviously they have to be restructured. Some people would like them taxed until they're, until they're fully funded. I think what concerns me is that it seems like a lot of our very troublesome political questions, we just sit around waiting for the courts to decide things for us. And so if the decision had gone the other way, we'd be in a completely different scenario. So I guess what concerns me is certainly with this question, but with a lot of broader questions, whether it's marriage equality or gay marriage or anything, we kind of just wait for the courts to grind out an answer that ultimately traps us into a corner where we finally have no choice. We have to do one thing or the other. Do you have any comment on that, the perspective of the courts becoming more and more the final arbiter of everything?
I think it's a great point, and I'd have to say I agree with you on that, that more and more the courts are becoming the default decision maker of choice, often in cases where either politics is broken down or people aren't willing to wait for politics to address these kinds of issues. And I agree that it's problematic. With respect to this particular issue in bankruptcy, I think a way to ask the question would be, do I believe that there can be a point where politics can't solve this problem? Could we reach a point where it's impossible to solve this, solve the pension problem politically or through some other non-judicial mechanism? I think that's a debatable point. Some people would argue that with cities and states, when they're in financial distress, if they tighten their belts enough, because they're always going to have tax revenues coming in and they're always, or almost always, is spending they can cut, that they can solve these problems in the end, and we should not allow bankruptcy. We shouldn't use the fallback of bankruptcy in the courts. I think that's a completely plausible argument. In the end, I don't agree with it. I do believe that politics can break down or that problems can reach a point of no return. And I think pensions are a great test case. I think in some places they have reached a point of no return. And so I do think bankruptcy is appropriate. And as I mentioned at the end of my remarks, I also think that the possibility of bankruptcy could have a beneficial feedback effect on the politics. But I think your point is a good one. And I think one could reach the conclusion we're leaning on the courts too much. You know, they're the least democratic institution we have, but they seem to be doing the most decision-making.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Once again, if you have a question for Professor David Skeel, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two questions in the queue right now. Let's go to our next caller.
Yes, hi, Professor. This is Leo Dombrowski, Society member in Chicago. As I'm sure you've heard, the Illinois legislature has just passed a bill that is intended, they say, to rescue our public pension system. Of course, the public sector unions are up in arms, and they are going to sue. And we have the same language in the Illinois Constitution that says pension benefits shall not be diminished or impaired. I'd like to see us taxpayers get out of the pension business and put everyone in a 401k system, but of course that's not going to happen anytime soon, certainly not here in Illinois. But has this issue, other than the Detroit bankruptcy, has it been litigated in courts anywhere else in the country?
So the kind of issue that's going to get litigated in Illinois has been litigated. And there's litigation in a number of different states. And the question typically is, does state law allow the adjustment of pensions? It's usually for current employees that are already employees of Illinois, for instance. Can you adjust their pensions even going forward, the future accrual of pensions? And in some states, California is one of the strictest on this, the courts have essentially said you can't, that there's almost nothing you can do. You cannot even make significant changes to the cost of living adjustment formula. That's what's going to be fought out, I believe, in Illinois, is does that state constitution provision, together with the case law interpreting it, preclude any significant significant adjustment to the pensions of existing employees. Obviously, you can make adjustments to future employees. Often, they're not trying to make adjustments for retirees. What they're trying to do is make adjustments for current employees. So it's a big question mark. It's a big question mark in Illinois which way this is going to go. I don't think it's at all clear that the legislation, assuming that it does go through, is going to be upheld. There's a real question there. If you can't even make adjustments going forward for existing employees, I think it really reinforces the importance of bankruptcy. Now, if there's nothing you can do outside of bankruptcy, the argument that we need bankruptcy as a last resort backstop gets that much stronger.
But of course, states unfortunately cannot file for bankruptcy. It's only cities and counties.
Well, that's right. Yeah, you can't do it with the state. And so what I should have said is that makes the argument for putting a state bankruptcy and framework in place much, much stronger. And that's an argument that I have been pushing over the last several years. And unfortunately for you, Illinois is the strongest case in support of enacting a state bankruptcy law, in my view.
Professor, is it your sense that many municipalities out there have been waiting for this decision and given the decision might act now, or do you have any sense of that?
It's definitely my sense that many municipalities have been waiting for the decision. I wouldn't say that all of a sudden we're going to see a bunch of them filing for bankruptcy, but what I would say is, to the extent the ruling in the Detroit case stands up and retirees are trying to appeal it, to the extent that ruling is affirmed, the effect it will have, in my view, is to put another very important tool in the toolbox of financially struggling municipalities. I wouldn't expect a lot of them to file right now, but I would say we would be likely in the coming months or in the coming year to see another substantial Chapter 9 filing. I do not think Detroit would be the end.
All right. Once again, we're speaking with Professor David Skeel. If you have a question for the professor, push the star button and then the pound button. A lot of our callers joined us late, so feel free to ask any question, even if you think the professor might have addressed it in his opening remarks. We've got one question pending, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, this is Joy Madero from California, and I was wondering if you were following the initiative efforts, the nascent initiative efforts here in California to reform pensions, and whether you think that would, to allow the reform of pensions more accurately, do you think that would be successful? I mean, it should be upheld if the initiative were to pass.
Yeah, this is a great question. I was not aware of the initiative effort. My understanding is that there is a pension promise in the California Constitution, so that it's viewed as a constitutional protection. So the question would be whether the Constitution can be altered by referendum, and I'm not an expert on this. I think the answer is yes, that it can be altered by referendum, but the question would be the mechanism in California for amending the Constitution, and I'm not certain of the answer to that question. That's very interesting to hear that there is a movement afoot in California, because California does have maybe the most restrictive pension laws. And I think it's fair to say it's harder to make any adjustments in California than almost anywhere else. There's a rule that I think comes largely from the case law called the California rule that forbids any alteration of pension that would diminish the pension in any way. So any change has to be offset by an addition to the pension. So to hear that there's an initiative underway is very interesting news.
Joanne,
it's being promoted by the mayor of San Jose.
The mayor, okay. You know, I have seen him interview.
The city of San Jose itself, or the voters of San Jose, did pass an initiative related to their own pension things, which I believe is under challenge.
Well, that's interesting. I've seen some interviews with the mayor of San Jose. I wasn't aware of the initiative part of it. I will definitely look into that.
Very good. We've still got one more question pending. Actually two now, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Will Ray. I'm calling from Brown Rudnick in Providence. I'm a member of the Federal Society. I'm very interested in this call because our office actually is involved in some of the pension litigation in Rhode Island. What happened here was that the state passed a law saying that municipalities could change the pensions. Municipalities, some of them, took the state up on that. In Providence, we represented the city, and the judge ended up saying she issued an injunction preventing the ordinance, which reduced the pension, from going into effect. And though we settled out, the judge ended up bifurcating between COLAs, which are, you know, pension money, and the health benefits promised under pension. And she seemed to think that pensioners were more likely to succeed on the health care claims than the pension ones, though that hasn't been formalized in a decision, but that was came out during the fairness hearing of the settlement.
So she was of the view that health care could not be adjusted, but the pensions could?
Yes, for two reasons. First, the pension adjustment in this case was supposed to be for a set number of years, and she thought that one of the things that's very important is the temporary nature of a contractual impairment. So that was going to be temporary, and then the permanent health care aspect was that they were being asked to switch from the city plan onto Medicare, which was substantially the same, she found. But earlier she had issued an injunction saying that the city, its mere financial emergency, wasn't severe enough to warrant that much of a contractual impairment.
Oh, that's interesting. So this was a contracts clause kind of argument.
Precisely.
Yeah, so that they could make the adjustments because it's a fiscal emergency, but the healthcare adjustments were beyond what the fiscal emergency warranted, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And then we never are going to get
that's
a...
That's really interesting. I had not heard about this either.
All right, we have one caller question pending. If you'd like to ask Professor Skeel a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Professor, this is Joe Russinello. I'm in San Francisco. I'm a society member. And if I remember a presentation recently put on here by someone from the Hoover Institute, they remarked that one of the reasons that there really wasn't the surfacing of all of the problems that the municipalities were having is that the rules by which they set up their budgets and account for unfunded pension liabilities sort of encourages concealment of the actual big dollar amount and only requires them to sort of identify the interest, you might say, on the on the pension. Are you familiar with that? And does this, I mean, has this contributed in a way to the calamity that's confronting all of these different municipalities around the country now?
I do believe it has contributed. I'm familiar with it more in a general sense than I don't know the chapter and verse of the budgeting rules, but my understanding is fully consistent with that comment. And my understanding is that in a number of states, this has created a huge incentive to deliberately underfund pensions as a way to run budget deficits without appearing to run budget deficits. So when governors in states with a balanced budget amendment, which all but one or two states have, decide they want to run a budget deficit, and they're not willing to tighten their belts enough to have a truly balanced budget, one of the main things they do is underfund pensions. And in fact, Chris Christie in New Jersey, in many respects, I'm fond of Chris Christie, but he pretty explicitly did that. He said we're not going to get our pension funding up to where it ought to be for now because we need the flexibility in our budget. So this is a big issue, and I think it is worth underscoring how much of the problem is underfunding in Detroit, in Chicago, in Illinois, in California. If the cities and states were actually funding their promises, nobody'd be worrying about whether you can restructure these things in bankruptcy, because everything would already be paid for. It's a problem because pensions are so underfunded.
Thank you.
We've got yet another question. Let's go to our next caller. If you'd like to join the queue for questions, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hello, this is Jim Edwards in San Diego. Could you comment on the probability of the success of the appeal in the Detroit case?
It's a great question. There's sort of two questions. One is whether the appeal will be allowed, whether it will go through. My guess is it will, but it's the law on it is sort of murky. It's a collateral order. It's not a final order because all the judge was technically saying is that Detroit gets to stay in bankruptcy. And there's some rules for when collateral orders can be appealed, one of which is if the bankruptcy judge certifies it to be appealed, then it can be appealed, and it's appealed directly to the circuit court. And I don't know that the Detroit judge has made a statement on that yet. But assuming that the appeal does go through and it goes to the circuit court, I think it's likely upheld. I mean, if the judge had not purported to address the pension issue, if he had said, we don't need to address that now because there's no proposal to restructure the pension on the table. We're just asking whether Detroit is insolvent and whether Detroit has done the other things a municipality needs to do before it can file for bankruptcy. If the bankruptcy judge had said that, I think it would be a no-brainer. I think there's no way he'd be overturned. And I still think it's unlikely he'll get overturned. But the fact that the pension issue has gotten rolled up in the overall should Detroit be able to file issue, I think makes it a little bit more uncertain. So if I had to predict, I'd say better than 50% chance it gets upheld, but a real chance it won't, at least if the circuit court decides they need to rule on the pension issue as well. Actually, let me say one more thing about the other issues, the issue of whether Detroit is a proper filer. I said I don't think the Detroit judge would be overturned on this. One of the requirements for filing is either that you negotiate in good faith, or you have to be insolvent, and you also have to show that you negotiated in good faith with your creditors, or that negotiating would be impracticable. One of the things the Detroit judge said was he didn't think the emergency manager, Detroit's emergency manager, did negotiate in good faith, that the quick negotiations before the bankruptcy filing were really a charade. But the bankruptcy judge said, given Detroit's predicament and how everything was falling apart, it would have been impracticable to negotiate with everybody, and the emergency manager was getting a lot of resistance as well. I don't think that ruling will be overturned. That's really a factual ruling, I think, so it'd be pretty surprising if that got overturned.
All right. Let me make a last call for questions. Our lines are open right now. If you have a question for Professor Skeel, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Still got some time left if anybody has a question. Here's another question, so let's go to our next caller.
Hello. Thanks, Professor, for taking your time to talk with us. This is Adam Siegel from Texas. I had a question on the eligibility for some of the municipalities to access Chapter 9 protection. My understanding is it's more rigorous than it is for, say, a Chapter 11 filing. And if there's to be an increase in filings, as you've thought through, you know, given the given this decision in Detroit, do you think that that eligibility standard will be a bar to some of the potential debtors that might want to access the code?
This is another great question, and I think the short answer is yes, that it is a potential bar. As you said, the eligibility requirements for municipal bankruptcy are much, much higher than they are for other bankruptcies. For an individual or a corporation that wants to file for bankruptcy, they don't even have to show they're insolvent. There are almost no entry requirements to filing for bankruptcy. With a municipality, they have to show that they're insolvent. They have to show, as I was saying a minute ago, that they've negotiated in good faith with creditors or that negotiation would be impracticable. And this adds up to a pretty significant entry barrier. And the insolvency requirement in particular can be very tricky because a court can ask the question, if the city sold off everything it could sell off, and if it were to raise its taxes and cut its spending as much as possible, would it be able to pay its debts as they come due? And in a lot of with a lot of cities, even cities that are in really serious financial state, in a really serious financial predicament, that may be a tricky question. It might not be clear they are insolvent. Detroit is very unusual in that regard. It's hard to argue, it's not impossible, but it's hard to argue Detroit was insolvent. Just one, for instance, on the extent to which the insolvency requirement can be a barrier to Chapter 9, a couple decades ago, Bridgeport, Connecticut filed for bankruptcy at a time they were in just horrendous shape. It's still not in great shape, but Bridgeport was in horrendous shape. The judge concluded Bridgeport had not done everything it could do to pay its creditors and kick the case out. So one takeaway from this is that the Detroit decision is not going to be opening floodgates. We're not going to see 50 municipal bankruptcy filings, as Meredith Whitney said a few years ago, in the next 6 months. I do think we will probably see one or two more big ones, but there are serious entry barriers, and that will cause many cities to think twice or three times before they go this route.
All right, we've got another question. If you want to ask a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another question.
Yes, hi, this is Harold Johnson in California. I have a question about whether the court, if it's once established, as apparently it has been at the trial level and maybe at the appellate level eventually, that the bankruptcy court can redo or revisit the pension contracts. Can it do so at its own initiative or at the initiative of other creditors if the city itself doesn't ask it to do so? This was how things were playing out in Stockton. The city sought bankruptcy protection but wasn't proposing to revisit its pension contracts, only to stiff other creditors.
Right, yeah. Stockton has been very striking in that regard in its refusal to put pensions on the bargaining table. So the short answer is the only party that can propose the pension cuts formally is the debtor, is the city itself. The creditors can't force the city to cut its pensions. The bankruptcy judge can't force the city to cut pensions. So the short answer is only the city itself can propose to cut pensions. The slightly longer answer is in a situation where it's clear that the pensions are a big problem and to the extent it's clear pensions can be restructured, that may be a factor in deciding whether a restructuring plan, an adjustment plan, is approved or not. So the bankruptcy court can't directly require the city to do anything. but it can say, I'm not going to approve this plan if you haven't taken as many steps as I think you ought to do, or if you are treating one set of creditors radically differently than you're treating another set of creditors. There's a requirement in Chapter 9 that the plan not unfairly discriminate, and that's traditionally been interpreted as meaning that you can't treat otherwise similar classes of creditors radically differently. So a bankruptcy judge could say, with respect to a proposed restructuring that left pensions untouched, that this plan seems to discriminate unfairly, or this does not seem to be in the best interest of creditors. So that the bankruptcy judge does have the power of the veto power, the power to say no to the plan. But at the end of the day, the only entity that can propose the pension restructuring is the debtor itself. And that's one of the striking things about Detroit, is the emergency manager is making that kind of a proposal. It's also being made, or it looks like it will be made, in San Bernardino's bankruptcy in California, but it was not made in Stockton. And the question at this point with Stockton is whether the main dissenting creditor is going to pursue that issue through the appeals process.
Thank you.
We have another question. Looks like it's again from California.
Yes, thank you. It's David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. The question has to do with sort of a concept of bonus payments under pensions. These are discretionary payments, which are time to time, not required, but done during the good years where the returns are exceptional. And the general thinking is that these should balance off the bad years, but when there's too much money on the table, apparently, and it's not uncommon practice, that bonus payments are made. So the question for the professor is, in the bankruptcy context, are you aware, or what do you think of the potential of clawing back some of these bonus payments, either as a fraudulent conveyance or perhaps some kind of a breach of fiduciary duty or whatever other theory you might have in mind?
So it's another really good question. These are what in Detroit are referred to as the 13th month payments that were made to pension beneficiaries in years when the pension assets had good returns. Not surprisingly, money was not taken away from them in years when the assets did not have good returns. I think as a legal matter, the argument for clawing back these payments is very strong, at least to the extent with respect to payments within the several years before bankruptcy, which is about how far the clawback statutes reach. I think it's unlikely that Detroit's emergency manager will try to do that. I don't think he'll actually try to claw back payments, but I think that will be more on practical grounds than on legal grounds. Interesting question will be whether he proposes making adjustments to who gets what based on whether you got these 13-month payments or not. It seems a little bit more likely that he would take those payments into account in determining who gets what from the funds that were set aside for pension beneficiaries. But I think it's unlikely he'll go after the payments. I think it'd be fairly complicated to go after them. But they certainly do look like fraudulent conveyances. It looks like payments that should not have been made. And so I think the not going after them, if they're not gone after, it will be for practical reasons rather than for legal reasons.
We do have time for one more question. If somebody's out there with a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Here's another question.
Yes, thank you. Lawrence Fossey here, a society member from New York. And I wonder, and I apologize if you've addressed this, but what can you tell us about whether Chapter 9 gives guidance about how you classify these different creditors in the bankruptcy now? For example, is a general obligation municipal bond holder an unsecured creditor? What about a bondholder whose bond covenants guarantee a stream of revenues from, say, sewer or water? And how does the court balance this against the claims of a pension holder? And what equitable considerations come into play, and with what rules?
This is another great question. These are really great questions y'all are asking. So Chapter 9 does say something about some of these issues. It doesn't fully resolve all of them. So starting with general obligation bonds as opposed to revenue bonds, it's pretty clear as a bankruptcy matter, in my view, that general obligation bonds are unsecured obligations, that they can be restructured. They're backed, they're not backed by specific assets. They're typically backed by the full faith and credit of the city or the state or whoever issued them. Revenue bonds, on the other hand, are given a great deal of protection in Chapter 9. They are treated as secured, collateralized obligations, and so revenue bond holders are entitled to continue to get payments during the bankruptcy case. So the short answer to the first part of your question is general obligation bonds in bankruptcy are unsecured. Revenue bonds are secured. It's pretty clear from Chapter 9. But there is, the longer answer is, there is, in my view, a very big disconnect between what bankruptcy experts think about the status of general obligation bonds and what the municipal bond market thinks about the status of general obligation bonds. The muni market, all of the muni market people that I talk to think that GO bonds are really high quality, high status, highly protected bonds. And they are typically shocked to learn that they're unsecured, that GO bonds are unsecured in bankruptcy. So I really think that there is a clash of cultures on the status of GO bonds, but I think the bankruptcy culture is going to prevail when we're in bankruptcy. So that's the answer to the first part of your question. The other part of it, which affects the answer to the first part, I think, is, as I was saying just a minute ago, one of the key requirements in Chapter 9, and this is also a requirement that is in Chapter 11 for corporate bankruptcies, is that a reorganization plan not unfairly discriminate among classes of unsecured creditors. And so unsecured creditors can be treated differently. Classes of creditors can be treated differently as long as there is a good reason for the treatment, that any discrimination is not unfair. And in my view, and I talk about this just a little bit at the very end, I think, of my white paper, in my view, there's an argument that a general obligation bond should be treated a little bit better than, say, a certificate of participation or another unsecured obligation of the city. Because, or at least to the extent that the general obligation has been formally approved by the voters, whereas many other obligations have not been formally approved by the voters. So there is a legitimate perception that a general obligation bond is a little different than other unsecured obligations. It doesn't seem to me that that's a basis for saying they cannot be restructured, but it may be a basis for giving a GO bond a little bit higher of a payout than other kinds of obligations. And I think the respective treatment of GO bonds and of other unsecured bonds and of underfunded pensions, the unfunded portion of a pension, that's going to play out under this unfair discrimination language. And there's not a clear answer to it, but that's going to be the legal term that's going to guide the discussion, I think.
Well, Professor, you've been very patient answering all these questions. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. I wonder if you want to take a minute or two to wrap up, express any final thoughts.
The main thing I'd want to say is these have been remarkable questions. It's not surprising, I suppose, that many of them came from states and cities where these are very real issues, places like or a number of cities in California, Providence, Rhode Island. But by way of conclusion, I would only repeat, I think, that this issue of whether pensions in particular can be restructured is a hugely important issue. And the answer to this question is going to determine whether Chapter 9 is an important tool in dealing with municipal financial crises or an unimportant tool, something that just doesn't play that much of a role. So I think the pension issue, the importance of it cannot be overstated. I also think the bond issues are very important, and it's going to be important in the Detroit case and to some extent in the California cases as well to sort out exactly what the status of different kinds of obligations is, because the worst thing that we can have, in my view, is uncertainty in the markets as to what the status of these obligations is. But these are very, very important issues, and as best I can tell, they will not be going away anytime soon.
Well, I think I'm convinced of that. I want to thank Professor David Skeel, and given your last remark there, suggest that we might be having you on again in the future if you're amenable.
I hope this issue continues to percolate. I'd love to do it.
Terrific. And to our audience, I encourage you to check our website for upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.